From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on October 23rd, 1941, when the Walt Disney Productions Company released the movie Dumbo. Can you recall what the film was about? I suspect you can. An elephant with big ears overcomes ridicule as he learns to fly. Now, do you remember the individual characters? How about a group of crows that discovers Dumbo sleeping in a tree? The crows were African-American stereotypes, and do you remember the name of their leader? His name was Jim Crow. All these years later, big media companies are still peddling racial stereotypes. In 2015, Netflix had to amend its description of Pocahontas, and a forthcoming documentary examines how much damage the character of Apu has done on The Simpsons. There are a lot of reasons that movies wouldn't hold up over time. Now, what tops your list? What's an example of something you might have liked or loved in the past, but on a recent reviewing, you felt differently? Are we supposed to see art differently as time progresses and we understand things better? Are there any good excuses for any of these Disney films which have my head spinning? My guests this hour include Jack Garner, a longtime film critic and the author of From My Seat on the Aisle. Jack, welcome back to the program.
Thanks. Good to be here again.
Les Friedman is here, professor and former chair of the Media and Society program at Hobart and William Smith College and co-author of Monstrous Progeny. Les, welcome back to the program
Evan.
To you.
Nice to be here.
And Jonathan Nketha is an actor, performance educator with Imperative Interactive and senior assistant director of the Multicultural Center for Academic Success in RIT's Division for Diversity and Inclusion. Jonathan, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
And Bree Merkel is artistic director for the Little Theater. Bree, welcome to you as well.
Thanks, Evan.
I was so ignorant about things like Dumbo because it has been years. And what scares me is thinking about, as a kid, did I internalize any of this stuff? Listen to what the crows sound like. These are the crows led by Jim Crow discovering, and by the way, we're laughing because of how ridiculously awful this is now, but this is 1941. They discover Dumbo. Let's listen.
Well, look at here, look at here. My, my. Why, this is most irregular. Well, I just can't believe my eyes. They ain't dead, is they?
No, dead people don't snow. Or do they?
What's all the rooker? Come on, step aside, brother. What's cooking around here? What's the good news? What's frying, boy? Just look down here, brother.
And prepare yourself for a shock.
Well, hush my beat.
That is Dumbo. And Les and Jack were saying before the hour, everybody in this room said, wait, you don't... I don't remember that. Bree, I don't remember. Did you?
Yeah, I don't remember it at all.
I don't remember that. And I don't want to remember that. But maybe did they take some of these scenes out as time goes on or no?
No, I don't think so. I think the reason I remember it is that I'm a father and a grandfather. So not only did I see it in my youth, right. My childhood, I also showed it to my children. And they haven't yet started showing it to their kids. I don't know. Maybe they have.
Did you have moments where you went back and saw it and you went, whoa.
Yeah, I mean, I became aware of the racism in it and the racial stereotypes, and of course, to me that connected to Amos and Andy, which I also grew up watching. Amos and Andy, a show which in many ways I really loved, but I feel it's a seriously guilty pleasure now, but there were parts of it that were very, very funny, and there were parts of some of the characters, like the cab driver, were really smart, even-handed, humane characters, but a lot of the characters were awful, awful stereotypes. They had a guy named Lightning that was just awful, and so that's what happened to the Dumbo. I mean, that was a ripoff of that. And then the characters in Song of the South, when Uncle Remus tells his stories, they go to cartoons. That's where we get the famous zippity-doo-dah scene. But in addition to the zippity-doo-dah scene, the fables of Uncle Remus are told through animal cartoons. There's a fox and a bear and all that. And they're clearly also Amos and Andy returns. So it's it was a sad thing. And I don't know what the answer is. You know, and part of me feels guilty for liking some of these things, but
yeah. And in a second, I've got another clip because I know Les wants to kind of remind us that some of these films are released with stuff taken out. We're going to get to that in a second. Jonathan, what do you make of that when you go back and listen to that?
It's interesting to think what was okay and what kind of always what gets the green light. You always wonder what gets the green light, and when you think about these characters, it goes back to this idea that people of color can only be in one box. There's only one shade, there's only one dimension, and that is all. And so for how long, when people don't have access to other people or people of color, African-American men in particular, is that all they see? Just those crows, you know, the talk or talking jive or whatever. We make all the jokes as we go on and on, but our world today has shrunk. We have access to people's truths and access to people's voices. But back then, it was limiting. And so we think about all the times and ways in which we need to be more than just the lines of that box. It's things like this that I feel have added to it and have made it last a little bit longer than it should have.
Well, and listen to, we got a short clip from Peter Pan when they did the song, What Makes the Red Man Red? Let's listen to this, and I know Les wants to tell us something about this. Go ahead, let's listen.
Why does he ask you how?
Hanamanaganda, why does he ask you how? What's the engine didn't know all things that he know now? But the engine, he sure learned a lot, and it's all from asking how.
I mean, so Les, weren't you saying before the program some of the films have been sort of recut with stuff taken out?
Well, they have, and you know, I was saying to you before the program, Disney is kind of low-hanging fruit when we go back and look at it now. I remember having a conversation with my daughter about Little Mermaid, saying, wait, this is all wrong. She gives up her family, she gives up her voice, she gives up her entire culture to marry this prince. And you know, there are problems with that. But let me just shift, say one thing and then shift quickly. When I teach older films, one of the things I ask my students to do is to think about them in the time they were made, not in the present, because of technology and because of these things. But what you said was absolutely right. It's still right to critique it. So let me start with the number one hit on my list, because you gave us this assignment, Evan.
Yeah, sure.
Gone with the Wind. Many people think that Gone with the Wind is the greatest American movie ever made, The Burning of Atlanta, etc. But it's particularly interesting to see that film, think about that film in the context of what's going on with statues in the South now and memorials to the Confederacy, because Gone with the Wind is the same as a statue to Stonewall Jackson. It really is mythologizing an era where there was slavery and there were plantations and you know, the heroes were the Southern gentlemen. And what do you do with a movie like that, that is in many ways great, but has a kind of pernicious undertone? Wow, with Gone with the Wind, it's not even an undertone, is it? It's an overtone.
Well, interesting. And critic at large, Jack Ferrick, wrote the following on the idea of reclaiming some of these old films and their racism. He wrote, quote, there's no grand conspiracy at work here, no coordinated efforts to suppress films, just a lot of individual decisions by individual stakeholders, individual determinations that this movie is a holdover from a less enlightened time, adding up to a benign neglect that lets demand languish until it finally ceases altogether. It happens now and then, especially with children's movies. Distributors take a look at their inventories and see an item that is suffused, even unintentionally, with a certain ugliness of spirit, and they let it go. They let it gently vanish. Disney has done it already with Song of the South, and they seem to be doing it now with Peter Pan. First, the movie's legacy is de-emphasized, then it slips out of the canon of classics, and then time is allowed to do its work, and the film is allowed to fade into obscurity until all that remains are fragments of songs and a few images that can be salvaged. Disney's Tinkerbell is more popular than ever. She stars in her own movies now with no Pan in sight. End quote. And maybe it should be that way. Jonathan, should it be that way? Should studios say, if we're going to do anything with Peter Pan or Song of the South, we're going to re-release, but we're going to try to excise what was hurtful? Or is that a reminder to who we were and what the times were?
It reminds me of my sons coming back from South Carolina, spending some time with grandparents, and Grandpa Bud loves Westerns. And my son came back and was talking about Westerns and, you know, sweeping landscapes, terse dialogue, and then Indians, right? And so the whole thing is, okay, well, that existed. That was Grandpa Bud loves Westerns. That's the thing he relates to him on. But let's talk a little bit more about who these Indians are. Oh, why don't we call them Native Americans? Let's learn about that. Taking the time to be able to look back at what was already created in that mindset and when it was okay to create this film, and look at it with the eyes that we have today. If we just allow it to exist and say, well, you know what, that happened, or pretend that we can sweep it under the rug, or that you know, Disney has always been kind, always been sort of pro women, always been about inclusion. It's a lie. We have to be able to acknowledge that it happened and show the progress of where we are. And we show that progress, and people can liken their own cultural progress to that, and that's when we become better as people.
Okay, Jack, what do you think?
Well, I think the editing issue is a tough one. It depends on what it does to the film in terms of the context of the narrative and everything else. But I think that I would love to see these films that are questionable, like Peter Pan, like especially Song of the South, and Dumbo, you know, perhaps there's a way to release them that they would then make them like a teaching point. I always have like a panel discussion on the disc or some darn thing. I don't know what. It's a challenge. I mean, because I you know, showed these things to my children and taught them about them and what those kinds of issues were about. Whereas there are other people who just put it on and let the movie babysit their kids. So that's the problem, and that's the issue. By the way, I momentarily want to put a little asterisk on the What Makes the Red Man Red and say it's a little weird to be talking about this in the days when people are still rooting for the Washington Redskins.
Yeah. You're right. You're right.
But that's a whole other issue.
But no. You're right.
But you know, the other thing I want to mention just briefly is what happens when you have really, truly great films that have a very small bit of racism. My favorite comedy of all time, better than Some Like It Hot, better than Animal House, whatever you want to name, is by a guy named Preston Sturges, and it's called The Miracle at Morgan's Creek. And the main character one of the main characters is a sheriff, Sheriff Cockenlocker, interesting name, played by the great William Demarest. And Bill Demarest says at one point in the movie, "That's mighty white of you." Mm. That's an old expression from the 40s that, you know, it's of its age, and that doesn't make it right. But the whole rest of the movie is brilliant. So what are we, that one line? I don't know whether you blurb it or what you do with it, but it's a problem. And another great example, Swing Time, one of the greatest of all the Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers movies. Fred Astaire does a beautiful dance in blackface.
That's right.
As a tribute to Bill Jangles, Mill Bojangles Robinson. So what do you do with that?
And of course, the jazz singer. Mm-hmm. I mean, go all the way back to blackface. You know, it's interesting. You know, whether you can indict all of Hollywood for this, it wasn't. I think the quote you read, Evan, is accurate. It wasn't a conscious thing. It was representative and a reflection of the inherent racism and sexism in the society. I mean, we could have the whole program on race. We could have the whole program on sexism. I mean,
but there had to be somebody who watched Dumbo or watched Mickey Rooney in Breakfast at Tiffany's, right, and said, "What is going on?" There has to. I'm uncomfortable with always cashing this check that says, well, get out of racism free because it was the spirit of the time. You know what the spirit of the time was? Overt racism. Mm-hmm. So it became more acceptable to have things, you know, that were just, I mean, look at National Lampoon's, and this is the 1980s. You got Chevy Chase and his family, and they get lost in St. Louis, right? And they're driving around looking for directions, and they come into what you would call a black neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And of course, all the stereotypes are there. And for this brief moment, you get Chevy Chase's character saying, you know, no, it's important that the kids see other parts of America, you know, and that this is, and then they hear a gunshot, and he says, roll them up. And what happens next? He asks a group of African-Americans for directions, and the African-Americans give them directions and steal their tires. And so all you had this chance to say something, and all it said was, I'm going to reinforce all the prejudice of the era, and I don't feel like less, I have to look back and say, well, you know, a lot of people felt that way. I feel like there are times to say, shouldn't have been okay then. Does that make sense?
I agree. It shouldn't have been okay then, but it was. But you then have to go the next step, Evan. What do you do with the film?
No, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
We have to watch them. So, I mean, obviously, you'll stay employed as a film professor, you know. But we have to look at them. And I think we look at the 80s. We look at the humor that was there. I think they were toying around with it. Perhaps there were more people at the table who could bring light to, okay, well, this is what it's like, you know. And then at the same time, to get an idea on the table, you have to pay for it somehow. Look at films such as The Toy with Richard Pryor and Jack Gleason. Watching that as a kid, it was was, you know, the Wonder Wheel scene. That was all it was. But going back as an adult and looking at it, it was incredibly smart. And you look at all the race yep. relations and you see what is happening, and you have all the, it's a fascinating view. And then you look at something like DC Cab, again, more comedic, but you've got a lot of these ridiculous stereotypes, and you say, well, it's this, you know, it's funny because it's true, and you get these people who are just crass together. And then you hear these little pieces in there. Gary Busey's talking to Adam Baldwin about how blacks, or different N-words, coming back from Vietnam and having guns and knowing how to fight, and basically talking about this the beginning of racism that gets people of color into prisons. But these little gems that you'll see in some of these 80s comedies, that because it was so slapstick, it just seems like, you know what, it was just a joke, you know, or it wasn't that serious. But I think there's a lot of meat to it. And when you go back and look at it with some eyes that have been seasoned, and you take it into context with what we're going through today, you can see, again, like I said, how far we've come or how far we've regressed.
I want to ask Bree a little bit too. You know, sometimes you look back at films, I'll take 16 Candles as an example. You grew up, it was part of the background of, you know, popular films of the time. Now you go back and you say, there's a scene where they celebrate rape. You know, the girl is so drunk, mm-hmm. the young woman is so drunk, gets passed off as a sexual object for the quote-unquote nerd, and that becomes a conquest to celebrate. No way could you do that today.
No.
But, you know, sometimes the little shows throwback films.
And yes.
Do you ever wrestle with stuff like that?
Yeah, we do all the time. Actually, different example, but just last month we played Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
That's true.
And we had a couple people call who were upset that we were playing that movie because of the representations of you know, Asian people, of mm-hmm. any sort of brown people, you know. So, and we understand that, and we try to be as sensitive to it as we can be. For that series, we were playing it on 35mm film. We were playing it in a series that's specifically supposed to be a throwback series, you know, a series where we're playing Back to School with Rodney Dangerfield this month. So obviously we're playing films that we don't feel are necessarily of like the highest artistic merit. We're playing things that maybe you saw on TV at the 80s. Like a lot of what we think for Saturday Night Rewind is, what did you see when you went to the video store in the 80s and 90s? And that's the movies that we focus on. But it is always an ongoing issue. And we did talk about it. We ended up deciding to play the film, but you know, it's so hard because it really, in a weird way, all just goes back to that context and the responsibility when you watch. And you just can't be there when a movie is being shown. It's media literacy, really. But, you know, that's a new term for something that's been going on ever since we started watching these things.
Listeners, if you want to call the program with examples of films that you think don't hold up over time, you can call 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Part of the question is, if you think a film doesn't hold up for certain reasons, and often it's because of racism, sexism, homophobia, what do you do with it? And, you know, this does in some ways evoke the debate in this community about the Take It Down Committee and the mm-hmm. work that they did with the Denzel Carousel, and the question of that old, the racist, the so-called Piccaninny art panel that I think now appropriately will be shown at the Rochester Museum and Science Center in a museum setting with context, but not to be seen sort of without context. And I guess, Jonathan, that's how I feel about some of these films. Mm-hmm. Some of them, we have to let adults understand that you're going to see a film and some things may offend you. But for kids, I feel it's different. That's why I look at the Disney films and I go, I can't. My 5-year-old can't watch that. Yeah. I can't do that. So that film belongs more in a museum to me than on some airwaves with the, hey, you know, it was a product of the time.
And I think also there's value in watching it again. You know, and I think the film is there, and once it's there, it's there forever. It's mm-hmm. and I think it's our responsibility to allow, like many of the people on this panel, to allow it to live and to exist for other folks, and to watch it another time when you've got, again, some more years under your belt. I never forget when my mom would always drop us at the Rundell Library for long stretches of time, and I would go to the film, the video room, and look at these movies that were just like old films, and I'd watch African Queen or look at these films that I would never watch anyways. But what did it mean to me then? It was, okay, they're on a boat in this river, and I wanted to see what representation of Africans were in that film. But beyond that, now you have some an opportunity for these Disney films to really show light. And Disney can, I think, be the ones at the forefront and say, hey, this is what we were. This is who we were. But this is who we are now. And some might argue it's not much better, but but I think that's the opportunity.
Yeah,
they did do that New Orleans film that was almost all African American characters. I forget what it was called, the Princess something. John was part of the music.
Princess and a Frog, where the only African American princess spent the majority of her time as a frog instead of.
Yeah, right.
Oh God,
that's true. That's a good point. You know what? You have to look at when you wonder why all these things come along and why they came along in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s and all right up to today, is who are wearing the suits in Hollywood? Who are the producers? Mm-hmm. Who are the money men? They are men. Mm-hmm. They're not women. They're not of color. You know what I mean? And that's where a lot of the trouble comes from. And by the way, if anybody thinks this is just of the golden age of Hollywood and onward, the most important early silent film, a piece of academic art that we have to study, and yet we study swallowing hard all the time, is The Birth of a Nation. It's just... And by the way, this is the first Birth of a Nation, 1912. Mm-hmm. but it's tough. And in fact, that there's even more of an insult in there. Not only are black characters played in ways that are detrimental, but in some cases, they're played by white actors.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people don't even know that Amos and Andy on the radio were white actors.
Right. And the Ku Klux Klan are the heroes in Birth of a Nation.
Yeah, right.
I mean, it is a stunning film that I have trouble teaching.
Let me grab our first phone call of the hour, and this is Nick in Henrietta. Go ahead, Nick.
Hey, Evan. Thanks for having me, and thanks for the panel for bringing up this issue. And it's never dead. It can always be refreshed, and we can always have new perspective, and I'm loving the conversation. If we could just return to the overall idea of watching and revisiting classic movies, can we possibly nail down what to put in our mental toolbox, things we can have when revisiting these movies that are essential to us today that we can use constructively? Thank you.
Nick, thank you. What can we do? What can we put in our toolkit to do that? Bree?
I think just talk it over with someone else. Watch the movie with somebody else. Or even seek out an opinion from someone that you haven't met before. Or, you know, I mean, that's one of the good things, you know, not to plug the Little, and not just the Little. There are a lot of places like this in Rochester, but going to see a movie in a community setting, that's one of the biggest advantages, is that you can have a discussion with your community, with people around you that maybe you haven't met before, and you can talk about something. I have seen people's views get changed at discussions after movies at the Little. I've seen it happen, and that is one thing that makes me really proud of where I work. So I think just it's always about involving yourself in the community, and so if you're talking movies, go see a movie with the people around you.
And also, I think you should be really as well read as reasonably possible. In other words, go online and not just some, you know, blog critics that you don't know who they are, but some serious, you know, writers of the New York Times or the New Yorker or somewhere, or history. Read a little bit on, thank God with the internet, it's all there. So do a little background on your film. Not that you want your spoilers out there, you don't, but you still want to know a little bit about it, and then go read it more afterwards where you don't care about the spoilers, but read about it.
Jonathan?
Yeah, I think it's asking yourself, is this okay? You know, first of all, films are made to lose yourself in them. But when we start to be led by them, then they can become propaganda. They can be used to divide instead of sort of inform us with more questions. They're not the answers to questions. This is one person or group of persons sort of take on a snippet of the world. And then there are billions of other stories that are happening simultaneously around it. So my suggestion is to be aware of who you are and where you are today. And then when you watch that same film again a couple of years later, or, you know, where are you then as a parent? Now I watch films and it's completely different from my 4 and my 6-year-old, where, you know, when I was in my 20s, I wasn't thinking with that lens. I think we have to make sure we incorporate where we are and what we've learned into what we're taking in.
Les?
No, I think that's a really good and articulate way to say it. Obviously, I'm in an academic setting, so we get to be able to contextualize it both with readings from the era and then looking at its relationship to what's going on today. So I think that kind of context is really important. This is an interesting topic because, of course, the film hasn't changed. We've changed, and the culture's changed. I mean, I remember, this is just a small personal experience, and I won't take too long to relate it, but a film I loved was the 1970 film Five Easy Pieces with Jack Nicholson. And the centerpiece of that film was a centerpiece in that film was when he was in a restaurant, he couldn't order what he wanted. I think it was a chicken. Was it a chicken salad sandwich?
No, a BLT maybe or something?
Well, that's whatever it was. Well, yeah. He couldn't order it, and it went on and on and on. And finally, he sweeps the whole table apart, and he yells at the waitress. And when we saw that film in the 70s, we cheered. We cheered. Now, I saw that film about a year ago, and I thought, what a jerk. Here's this waitress who's been working a 10-hour shift. She's just following the rules that the manager sets up for her. I mean, I was just horrified by this action. And I thought of other films like that, like Love Story, which I saw recently, which was a popular film. And today, you just shiver. Now, it's not racist, but it's, I don't know.
Corny.
Yeah. It just is like, doesn't work much anymore.
But you know, that Five Easy Pieces brings up another interesting point, and Jonathan, you made this too, about when you approach films later.
Yeah.
The other thing that changes is who you identify with and have empathy for in the film. I mean, I saw, you know, Five Easy Pieces in 1970. I was all about Jack Nicholson.
Yeah.
When I see it now, I think of the old man in the wheelchair.
Yeah.
I'm not in a wheelchair, and I'm not that old yet, but it's coming. You know what I'm saying? So, yeah. And that's just an extreme example, but you do find different approaches based on where you are in your own life.
Right,
you know?
Right.
On the subject of racism in film, though, I do want to give a little bit of credit to one area that I think Hollywood's gotten a little better at, it, and that's in what I would call generally war films. And by that, I mean the platoon films, the Vietnam films.
Right.
Vietnam was very notable for being the war that was largely fought, not largely, but a good majority of it was fought by African Americans, disproportionate to their population. And in both Apocalypse Now had two black fellows on the boat, not that's one. Yeah. And Platoon also had a lot of African-American characters. So they make an attempt to be aware of that. But again, that's up to the individual filmmakers. And those were two filmmakers who know how to make
a movie. Spike made a film.
Spike
Miracle
is
in St. Anna. Yeah.
Right.
I go back to kind of looking at parallel worlds. So you, for every L.A. Confidential that I hear, that's a great film. You have to watch that film in that sort of genre. I then throw Devil in a Blue Dress. To sort of take into a completely different angle in different cultural contexts. When you talk about passing, you talk about African Americans coming back from a war and trying to find their place in a city that is divided.
Right.
And I think that's a great way to be able to create context, is not to just look at one film from that era or from that genre, but to then take it from a different perspective and maybe look at another one.
I'm sorry. I was signaling to our producer only because we're late for a break. So
no,
sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Go.
Here's what we're going to do. We got to get our break in. If you're on the phone, we've got a bunch of phone calls to come in to join the conversation. And what I want to do also is I want to read for you when we come back what Warner Brothers has to say about this. Now, Warner Brothers put their own disclaimer on, and I thought that was interesting, with Whoopi Goldberg reading it. So we're going to I'll read with the language of what Warner Brothers decided to do when they were going to release Looney Tunes Golden Collection Volume 3 with a disclaimer read by Whoopi Goldberg. We'll read that disclaimer, see what our panel thinks, take more of your phone calls when we come back here. Let's go ahead and do that and get our only break of the hour right here on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, we're gearing up for Fashion Week of Rochester, which kicks off on October 10th. The five-day event features runway shows highlighting local and national designers, and it gives back to the community. Last year, the event raised more than $600,000 for the Center for Youth, which helps young people who are homeless. We'll also hear how the center is expanding. It's opening a second crisis nursery later this year. Talk with you Wednesday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our subject this hour, films that don't hold up for various reasons, often because they're made at a time where we look back and can hardly believe that we would present race or sexuality or homophobia, things like that. And our panel is discussing not only what films sort of fall into that category, but also what do we do about it. Jonathan Niketha is an actor, performance educator with Impact Interactive, and senior assistant director of the Multicultural Center for Academic Success in RIT's Division for Diversity and Inclusion. Bree Merkel, artistic director for the Little Theater. Jack Garner, a longtime film critic and the author of From My Seat on the Aisle. And Les Friedman, professor and former chair of the Media and Society Program at Hobart and William Smith Colleges, and co co-author of Monstrous Progeny. Before I jump to your phone calls, I promised you I would read what Warner Brothers wrote. So here was the Warner Brothers disclaimer, and they needed this disclaimer for a lot of reasons. If you go back to the old Warner Brothers cartoons, whew, there was a lot of things now that you would never do today. Here's their disclaimer that was read by Whoopi Goldberg on that DVD collection. Quote, the cartoons you are about to see are the products of their time. They may depict some of the ethnic and racial prejudices that were commonplace in the U.S. society. These depictions were wrong then, and they are wrong today. While the following does not represent the Warner Brothers' view of today's society, these cartoons are being presented as they were originally created, because to do otherwise would be the same as claiming that these prejudices never existed. End quote. Jonathan, what do you think of that?
Yeah, I think that hits the nail on the head. It's about it existed. It's not about assigning blame. It's not about trying to say, you know, to say all the comebacks that you wanted to have said years ago and no one would listen to you. It's just about accepting it and then seeing where we can go from here. And we all know that cartoons and everything today are marketed towards the parents, and it's all nostalgia. So let it be what it is. Create something new and allow new people to share their voices through this medium.
Okay. I love the line that you know, it was wrong then. It's wrong now, and it was wrong then. I mean, yeah. The fact that she doesn't excuse it with the, you know, old times card, mm-hmm. is kind of important.
Okay, Les, what do you think?
No, I thought it was perfect, and the fact that Whoopi reads it is even more interesting.
I have a long list of listener comments. I want to squeeze in some phone calls, so let's go ahead and grab some here. Wendy in Rochester, go ahead, Wendy.
Good afternoon, folks. Your discussion has brought me back to my childhood when I was watching all these movies, and I really enjoyed them, and now, a couple of months ago, I watched movies such as Dimples and The Lewis Rebel, a couple of Shirley Temple movies, and I could not stand them. Also, I just know that I love old movies, and a lot of ethnic groups did not make out well in those old movies. And I just look at the black... Remember the black actors like Stepan Fetchit? I would use his real name if I knew it. Haddock McDaniel, Louise Beavers, folks who are really pioneers out there trying to work in the white studio system, and they couldn't get above that, what I call the racial ceiling. They had to play maids and butlers, and people who are not too bright. Also, I remember the movies that I saw in the 50s and early 60s, such as Pinky. I don't know if anybody remembers that one. I Passed for White. Mm-hmm. And Imitation of Life, yep. Both of them.
Right, and Showboat, same thing. You know, I was going to say, and we haven't talked about this quite yet, you have to understand that Hollywood is a business, and they had to market their, this is not an excuse, I'm just telling you what they would say. They had to market their films to the South, and they could not, would not, they thought they could not, let's put it this way, and again, I'm not making an excuse, I'm just stating what they have stated.
You're channeling the white male executives
They could not market some films to the South. They couldn't market a white woman kissing a black man. Let's just start there.
The famous story about that, and it's true, is that Lena Horne had enough talent and beauty and everything else to be a mainline star. But all the film appearances that she made were small parts or cameo parts that did not fit into the main narrative arc, so that when the film played in Alabama or Mississippi, they could cut her part out and it wouldn't affect the narrative arc.
Right.
If I can add to what Les was saying too about, and that's what I was thinking, Hollywood is a business. So going back to what I think his name was Nick, the caller, said about what's in your toolbox, I think that's another important point. You have to go out and support films with positive representations of other races, of women, of, you know, different gender representations, because it is all about money. When movies make money, those movies become classics. Those movies become things that people know. So when a movie comes out that has these positive representations, bring your friends, make it known, spend that money on the ticket or get it on demand, do what you need to do. But that is the only way that things can really change and start to get stacked in a different direction.
I've always said that you can, you have a vote. People who complain about movies, you have a vote. The vote's at the box office.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's
exactly
right. I know, you know, this is going to sound silly, but I have my own problems with Mel Gibson's anti-Semitism. And I had to be on a panel about Mel Gibson, and I was torn because I had to go see the Mel Gibson movie. So I bought a ticket to another movie. And then I went to see the Mel Gibson film. I want to give Mel Gibson my money.
You're the man.
Yeah, I don't want to give Mel Gibson my money.
Can I also just ask our panel briefly to respond here? Because I go back to what Nick said again, more tools on the toolkit. I've got a couple of emails from listeners going, okay, come on, Apu on The Simpsons, is that really offensive? Listen, you haven't seen the documentary yet, nor have I. I've only seen the trailer. The forthcoming documentary is called The Problem with Apu, and it was created by a comedian named Harry Kund Dabalu, who is an Indian comedian, and he talks to many successful Indian comics, people like Asif Manvi, who you would know in this mm-hmm. country, but people who've been successful, and every one of them deals with stereotypes that come from the character of Apu, created by a white guy, Hank Azaria, for The Simpsons, in which Hank Azaria has said he was told to make it as offensive as possible. And so, for me as the white guy, I go back to what Jack said. Yes, most of the time these decisions, what's been happening for decades, were made by white males. So maybe my job here is to step back and not say, oh, you can't be offended by Apu, and just listen a little. I really want to see this film because I have liked The Simpsons, but I got to look within a little bit here. And sometimes I just want to listen. That's all I want to say. Does that make sense, Jonathan?
It does. I think that is what we can do. And like Bree was saying, we listen with our time, with our money, with the questions that we have. And it's bigger than just, I think, the viewers and the producers. It also comes down to those who make it. And as an actor, come across all my feeds about all of the Asian actors who are Asian roles that are being given to whites.
Right.
And
yeah.
Ed Skrein most recently stepped away from the Hellboy reboot. Because he should look up his response and why he said he did it. You also have Mandy Patinkin on The Great Comet and Broadway. It takes all of us to be able to say that this isn't the world that I live in, and my world is more colorful, my world is more enjoyable when I'm listening to these stories and allowing other people to bring themselves to these roles.
I can imagine people sitting out there listening saying, oh, God, political correctness has just gone a little far. This hour is just painful to listen to. But I think you have to grasp that what often is characterized as political correctness is simply respect on some level. And the second thing you have to grasp is that the more the product seems like it's pure entertainment, the more powerful it is to deliver its message. So when you have an overt comedy about racism like Blazing Saddles, which we could talk about for a long time.
I've got a clip. We're going to get there. Because I want to grab a couple of phone calls. But Les, I've got a clip on that because we've had a lot of questions. I think that that's actually in a different category. But I have a question about that. And I'm not the expert on this. But before we get to Blazing Saddles, let me grab a couple of phone calls. Joel in Rochester. Go ahead, Joel.
Yeah, I would like to make a couple comments about two classics that were made in the early 40s, the Casablanca and the Maltese Falcon. They're different observations about racism. In Casablanca, Ingrid Bergman refers to Dooley Wilson as "Who's the boy at the piano?" You know, overtly racist comment. But in the Maltese Falcon, there's a scene in a hotel lobby where there's a black couple standing at the counter who dressed very nicely and appear to be guests at the hotel, which in itself was shocking in 1941.
Thank you, Joel. Any thought? Yeah. Listen, I've got a lot of listeners who want to jump in with their own recollections and memories and thoughts on this. This is Marilyn in Penfield next. Go ahead, Marilyn. Marilyn, unfortunately, I'm going to put you back on hold. You got to keep the radio down and listen through your phone if you can. We've got Dina in Rochester. Go ahead, Dina.
Hi, Evan. Yes, I was just actually with family yesterday. You know, it's interesting because Gone with the Wind movies did come up, but I wasn't in the conversation. And my mother, who's in her 80s, and my sister and in-laws, they were just so angry about the whole thing. So my comment is, it's fascinating how people, some people evolve, and some people are content just being who they are and not opening their minds as time goes on. And it's very sad and disturbing to me. Thank you.
Thank you, Dina. I take the point. I mean, we're getting a wide range of feedback. And, you know, I think for some people like me, you missed some of these things growing up watching these films. And now you go back and you feel like, wow, this was us here. And to Les's point on political correctness, I think there's a difference between what George Carlin railed on political correctness, using too many words to describe things that you know, economically disadvantaged instead of someone who is poor. Mm-hmm. Those kind of, I understand Carlin's critique on those grounds, and sometimes I do think we can get too PC or a little too careful. But at the same time, a lot of the time, the complaint I hear about political correctness is just people who want an excuse to say or do bad things.
I agree.
And if you cannot make comedy or a movie without peddling racial or stereotypes against oppressed groups, then you're just not doing a good job because you can do it without it. That's what I would say to political correctness. Let's talk real briefly about Blazing Saddles. A lot of listeners have asked about this. Now, when I was growing up, all I remember was the scene where a guy punches a horse. I thought that was funny. The older I got, I went back and revisited it. I was very uncomfortable. Going back before this program, I read some articles and people said that this was 1974, you know, right at the tail end of the civil rights, you know, of the 1960s, and that Mel Brooks was making a commentary about white flight. That this was actually a commentary that derided the fragility of white people and used some really harsh, you know, language to do it. Now, you couldn't use the language today. We've got a clip that has been edited, I think. So let's go ahead and listen to the clip from Blazing Saddles, and we'll come back and talk about it.
Now, come on, boys. Where's your spirit? I don't hear no singing. When you were slaves, you sang like birds. Come on, how about a good old work song?
I get no kick from champagne. Mere alcohol doesn't thrill me at all. So tell me, why should it be true that I get a belt out of you? Some get a kick from cocaine.
Hold it, what the hell is that? I meant a song, a real song, something like Swing Low, Sweet Chariot.
Swing low, chariot.
Don't know that one, huh?
So who's the hero of that scene?
Well, this—if anybody has a right to complain, it's the rednecks. This is a redneck organization should complain about being racially stereotyped in that one. Yeah, I'm being a little facetious here, but the other ones who come off, you know, he comes off as the idiot in this thing, and I think the film's a wonderful parody, and we got to differentiate between parody that has a point that is basically positive, as opposed to parody that is a point that is racist.
Yeah, there's nothing I can look at Peter Pan and some of those songs, just overtly racist stereotypes, no value. I am not a scholar on Blazing Saddles. I'm listening to people who know a lot more than I am. And Jack, what you're saying is this was part of the point was to pillory these racial stereotypes,
right,
or racial fragility?
I think so. I'd like to think so. Mel Brooks is a smart fella, and I think I would hope that's what it is. That's the way I take it. So, like, you know, I mean, that's why I'm comfortable with that movie.
Okay.
Right, Jonathan, are you comfortable? You're shaking your head.
Well, yeah, I mean, I got flashbacks to being in college and at parties, people asking me for weed, if I can help them score some weed. I mean, it's the same thing. Like I said before, people have a box. They want to put you in that box, and that's where it is. And if you can't look at something like this and see the absurdity of it and find, again, the opportunity for dignity through a character, that part there is the essence, I think, of the black experience in America, where you know what? You have to maintain a level of dignity. You could go out and, you know, say something, give the people peace of your mind, start cursing them out, whatever, go back and forth, or just sort of like, I don't know that song. I don't know what you're talking about. It's just unfortunate that it was said in 74. Mm-hmm. I dealt with it in the late 90s, and I'm sure someone right now is dealing with it today.
But aren't they showing this particular group of African Americans in a positive intellectual light by singing a beautifully harmonized Cole Porter song?
Oh, absolutely. I think we're looking at this, and when someone else just watches it, hey, let's watch this movie on Saturday morning when we're hungover, and they're laughing at it. What are they getting out of it? Are they being educated about it? Are they understanding what satire actually is? Are they understanding how far Mel Brooks chose to go with his comedy instead of having some more subtle things or more slapstick to then get to, like, again, going transitioning to the 80s with that type of comedy and film?
You bring up a really great point, I think, and that is what people bring into a movie. I remember once seeing The Wild Bunch, nothing to do with this topic today, but The Wild Bunch, and I thought it was a film about the horrificness of violence. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple scenes in there where I'm going, oh my Lord, and I'm just so shaken. And meanwhile, in front of me, a woman stands up and yells, "Get him!" It's what you bring into a film, that causes that.
I mean, about Blazing Saddles, I must admit that I like the film as well. And I think that Brooks is a smart filmmaker. And I think that he paints the Cleavon Little character, who was supposed to be Richard Pryor, but they wouldn't insure Pryor to do the film. Pryor helped write it, as we all know. And, I don't know how you can watch that film and not see the white people as idiots and Cleavon Little as the smartest guy around and the coolest guy around. Has anyone, Jack, or anyone else seen Detroit? I haven't seen it.
Not yet. I'm dying to.
Yeah, I want to see it also. And I'm very curious how that plays out. The other thing we should just quickly mention, and I'll just say it quickly and we can move on, is Sidney Poitier. He's there. He has been a man of integrity and character in all of his films. And perhaps the sad part is he's a lone example through the ages. But he managed to offset that stereotype, even though he got grief from some in the black community.
Yeah, and I think this still does to a point. Though the two films that I was thinking about were, because Sidney Poitier just is the one person who can get away with slapping white people on film.
Yeah.
In The Heat of the Night, understanding the context of it helps you understand how intense that would have been, how important it was to see that on film. And then again, looking in A Patch of Blue, being able to be an African-American male in an open setting, slapping this white woman who was abusing her blind daughter. There are these things, he was able to carry, again, a level of dignity. And Jack, like you said, with Song of the South, the main character was the only one who had a level of dignity. And I think, again, that's, despite all of these things and these boxes and lines, there's still this intense dignity that comes out and can come out through film when you're able to see it through a new lens.
All right, let me grab one more phone call. This is Mike in Rochester. Go ahead, Mike.
Hey, guys, I'll keep it quick. And I was just going to ask the panel if they think that Tarantino's film career and his choices of, race for certain characters or who the hero might be, if that has anything to do with the dignity of the film and his use of what a lot of people would say is just offensive racism. Hmm. But I think he is a culturalist. I think he shows you what regular people are like in the world. And I was just wondering if they had a take on him as a modern filmmaker who uses real controversial use of race. Thanks.
Mike, thanks. I have no clue on Tarantino.
He's actually most famous, I think, in terms of this controversy, for being the white guy who most frequently in his film uses the N-word.
Right. Yeah, which I don't think is a pro. I mean, that I'm kind of on both sides with Quentin Tarantino. I like some of his movies a lot, but that's a really hard part of Pulp Fiction to get past in the same way as other movies we've been talking about. And yet that movie is a lot more modern. And so that's something that's really hard to reconcile if you're you know, I don't think that you can 100% just say you're a Tarantino fan without addressing that at some point. You know, we play them all at the Little, and you know, Tarantino himself has a ton that you could look up and read about what he has to say about all that.
And we have about 30 seconds. Jonathan, you want to jump in there?
Yeah, I'm not the biggest Tarantino fan. I know Robert Forster and Jackie Brown, I think, is we got to give Rochester some props here. But I think he gets away with it. But for me, I think that Tarantino gets away, but I think it always comes back to why you're choosing to say that. And as was said before, if you can say something without using that word, why not? And it just seemed like it's an excuse. It's every time I watch it, it's just an excuse, and it's a vehicle for him to have that word spoken or said in that way. And it's not an authentic place. And I don't know him, but I don't know if I can trust where it's coming from. It exists, and black people seem to exist at his whim.
Brie, I want to mention before the hour is out, coming up on Friday, September 22nd at 7 p.m., the Black Cinema Series at the Little Theater presents a special screening of Birth of a Movement.
Yeah, and kind of a perfect example of what we were saying about come and talk with other people in the community. It's about the first organized response, I think one of the first biggest organized responses to a movie, Birth of a Nation, in the country. And when that movie came out, there were protests all around the country against Birth of a Nation. So that's not a new thing. It happened when the movie came out. Birth of a Movement is the name of the movie. Birth of a Nation is the name of the movie it was protesting. Right, a little confusing.
I was just going to say, on the other hand, the President of the United States praised Birth of a Nation and said it was history written in lightning. So it gives you a sense of it. Wilson.
Woodrow Wilson did?
Yeah.
Which is not a surprise.
Yeah.
Given it. But I want to thank all of our panelists for being here and with this discussion about how our view of art and films changes with time, hopefully appropriately so, but we all have a lot of work left to do, and I want to thank all of you for being here. Thank you so much for
welcome.
For taking
thanks for the invitation.
Really appreciate that. Our engineer, Rob Braden, our producer, Megan Mack, our intern extraordinaire, Audrey Sample. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a great afternoon. We're back with you Wednesday on member-supported public radio.